The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Caleb Azuma Nelson. British Ghanaian writer Caleb Azuma Nelson's debut novel, Open Water, is, according to The Guardian, an intense, elegant tale of two young Black British artists who find love as they struggle to succeed in an environment that simultaneously elevates and rejects them. It was named to scores of publications' most anticipated books of 2021 lists, including Esquire, Vulture, Onyx Magazine, and the UK edition of Vogue. Nelson has contributed writing to The White Review and Litro, and he recently won the People's Choice Prize and was shortlisted for the BBC Short Story Award. Also an acclaimed photographer, he was shortlisted for the Palm Photo Prize. And I also just want to quote from an absolutely stellar and delightfully ethereal review in the New York Times. Quote, "Only great artists can craft novels from water. Family, grief, Blackness, Frank Ocean, hip-hop, dancing, growing up, breaking up, London, oppression, beef patties, basketball, diasporic trauma. For Caleb Azuma Nelson, it's all water." One of my favorite recent reviews. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Megha Majumdar, author of A Burning, a New York Times bestseller that was long listed for the National Book Award. She also is a senior editor at Catapult Magazine and earned a master's degree in anthropology from Johns Hopkins University. Caleb, Megha, thank you so much for being here, and take it away.
Thanks so much, Jason. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited to chat with Caleb. I love this novel. This is the book we're talking about today, Open Water. It's a brilliant novel. It's a love story whose joyfulness, whose gentleness blew me away. It's an incredibly moving examination of life in a racist and often violent world. And like Jason just said, there are so many fans of this book, from Ya Jesse, who's right here on the cover, to the New York Times, to CNN, to Vogue. I hope you'll read this book. Please borrow it or buy it from an independent bookstore. And perhaps we can start by having you, Caleb, introduce the book in your own words, followed by a reading.
Yeah, of course. Firstly, Megha, thank you for tonight. I'm really excited to be in conversation with you. Yeah, this is my debut novel, Open Water. It's a love story set in Southeast London about two young artists who meet in a bar by chance and have this very instant and immediate connection, and find this connection kind of, it comes together and then it's severed, and it comes together and they just find this like blossoming love tested over distance and circumstance and time. But it's also like it's an ode to Black expression and to Black art and the various emotions that can be mapped using Black expression. So I'm going to read a bit for everyone now. "You say, the sky has erupted and there's white ash on the ground. The dog has never seen snow before. It alternates between bounding across the icy plains and staying stock still, aside from the tiny shake in its hind legs. Your grandma had never seen snow until the year you were born, while she awaited your arrival, and those tender flakes fell in a furious storm, clumping on the ground. She got on her knees and began to pray for herself, her daughter, and unborn grandchild. On the same day, your mother was on the top deck of a bus, cowering as a man waved a gun, and she emerged unscathed. You're not religious, but when you hear stories like that, it makes a man want to believe. You imagine your grandma in fervor, praying for your body barely formed, your spirit in gestation. Now her body is falling apart, or rather has fallen. Her spirit is everywhere. You don't know if you'll ever return and see where she's been laid to rest, but on this occasion, you do not have the strength. You're not religious, but you're praying for your own mother and father as they make the journey back to Ghana, back home. Your knees are on hard wooden floor, prostrating at the foot of your own desires, when a dog nudges you in the back. The dog has never seen snow before. The sheet above is cloudless, lacking in form and detail. Have you ever looked at the sky at night after it has snowed? Orange glow, light caught between somewhere. Makes you want to reach up and touch. So sometimes you pray. If prayer is mostly desire from the inner self, then you're praying for a safe trip for her. Thank you.
That was beautiful, Caleb. I love how you read preserving the great silences of the book. I really love that. Maybe we can start with a very basic question, which is, how did you come to the idea for this book?
Before I started writing Open Water, I was writing a lot of nonfiction, just kind of like working on essays for the sake of writing. I was trying to explore a lot of different things. I was thinking a lot about my photography practice, but also like the way that we see each other, especially when you're Black or of color. And so I was writing about that, and I was writing about fine art and music. But I was also writing a lot about love and the idea of love as a site for freedom. And that was an idea that kept returning in all of these essays that I was just spending my time writing and working through. And in May of 2019, I signed with my current literary agent, and I gave her these essays. That was the reason that she asked to see them and was like, you have the voice for a novel, you should write a novel. And so that was really the starting point. It was like, I didn't have any sort of like, okay, like these are my characters or this is what I'm bringing. Like I just had this idea of love as a site for freedom and all of this work that I'd been doing, like exploring Black expression. And so I started writing. Like I wrote through most of the summer, and by September, in some like sort of fever dream, I'd like finished like what is 95% of like Open Water as it is now. Like it felt like such a blur. Like I can't remember a lot of that process.
Wait, I feel like every writer in the room right now is, hold on, you wrote this novel in a summer? Don't tell us that stuff, Caleb.
For real. And it was like, it was funny. I think I've mentioned this in a couple of interviews, but when I started, I wrote between like May and June, and I went on holiday, and I gave my agent my draft, and I was feeling like so good about this draft. I was like so confident. And I came back after a week and she was like, yeah, this is not going in the right direction. You have to start again. And so I started from scratch, like in the middle of June, and was just like, I was trying to corral all of these ideas and thoughts and feelings that I'd had, and like the original sort of direction for the narrative was a lot more scattered. Like the voice was there, I think the style was there, but like it didn't have the backbone through it. And so I'm really glad that she suggested that I sort of scrap it and start again, because I'm just like so proud of what did emerge.
Wow. And so at what stage did you get to the two central characters, the photographer and the dancer? How did they emerge?
They came really, really early on. I think in the original draft, it actually started with the point at which they're meeting separately. And so that was my starting point when they meet separately and have this kind of like evening together. I'm really happy that we sort of reworked it, because it allows for a sort of build up towards that sort of magical evening they spend together, like after they've had this very like intense and immediate attraction. I think the having him as a photographer was really important for me, just because it allowed me to think and sort through these ideas of like seeing and like looking versus seeing, which is a refrain that I use a lot through the book. And wondering how like photography and like my visual practice could afford these characters like a space where they could be very full and very whole, and that they could be seen as they would want to be seen, and then exploring what happens when they aren't seen as they would want to be, when they're kind of like pushed into a little box and said, oh, this is who you are based on what you look like.
Yeah. I want to ask you more about what you bring up here about looking versus seeing. It was so striking because the book begins with this character being seen at the barber shop, and then there's a really striking scene in the middle of the book where the character is seen by the police when they're looking for someone and stopped. So the character does exist in this world where they are seen in different kinds of ways in these different places. And of course, the seeing that happens when he's with his partner is so full of love, so full of tenderness and care. Can you talk more about looking versus seeing and how that was... why that was such a foundational thing for you in this book?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's like I was really aware of the sort of like limits of language when I was writing this. And I was trying to like foster like this atmosphere where like I could describe something or I could write a scene and it was something that you could really feel. Like you could feel like that feeling of like being surrounded by this love and this tenderness and being like seen and like looked at in a way where you're like, the person opposite me actually really cares for me. And then vice versa in other situations where you're like, oh, like this is a situation where I might be in danger, or I don't know what lies on the other side of this interaction. And I think that's something that so many of us encounter every day, you know, this like this experience in like private versus public spaces, whereby like in private spaces, like you could be with your partner or with friends or with family, and you know that like for the most part people were seeing you as like you want to, and if they aren't, then maybe you could check them, maybe you could be like, hey, hold on a second, like let's think about this. But I think whenever you leave the confines of like these private spaces, these smaller spaces, and go out into the world, especially like when you look like me, there's not that much control over your environment and how people are actually seeing you. A lot of the time people will make their own decisions before you get a chance to open your mouth or even do anything.
Yeah. You're talking about the limits of language. You're talking about photography. You're a photographer yourself, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about what do you photograph?
It's mostly all portraits. It's all portraits of like black and brown people. Kind of like, yeah, like I've been working on a project for like the past, I don't know, like we're getting to 10 years at this point, where I will like ask my friends or people that I know or people that I meet if I can photograph them in a space that's comfortable for them. So it might be their home environment or like their working or creative environment, or it might be in a park, It might be in a forest. And I guess what I'm trying to do is afford people a space where they can be very honest and be like the full version of themselves, like kind of really flesh them out in a visual space. Because I think, you know, photography as a medium is very visceral. Like you see an image and it's like, it can really hit you, and it can really communicate something in the gaze or in the stance or in like how people aren't looking and just in their shapes and forms. And that was something that I really wanted to bring to the novel, like this idea of like looks and gazes and glances. But also I think whenever I'm like photographing people, especially black and brown people, I'm just like, what are the possibilities that I can afford to people in this moment? Or what space can I carve out so that people are like kind of can afford themselves like this sense of infinitude, this like just like anything could happen, when I don't think that's like the general day-to-day for everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And can I ask, what do you find fulfilling as an artist when you move back and forth between these two mediums? What do you find in each, and what are you looking for in each?
I think in both, I'm looking for a sense of honesty. I'm looking for like a kind of, or I'm looking for someone to be like trying to reach towards that, because I know that a lot, there's not really an end point. Recently, I was watching a video of Daniel Kaluuya, who is an actor and was in Judas and the Black Messiah. And it was just after he won his Oscar, and he was kind of holding this statue, and he was talking about like, he was like, you know, this is just a checkpoint, like the process is the most important thing. And that's such like a big thing for me. Like I love seeing and reading work that feels like it's on a journey, and that it's consistently doing that. It's consistently moving. It's trying to get towards something, knowing that that endpoint keeps moving away, right? I think I'm also always looking for work that moves me, in a sense that I'm like so much of like photography or writing that like really resonates with me has moved me because of its honesty, or because of the will to like try to express oneself as honestly as possible.
I love that. I think that it's so great that is explicitly part of your ambition as a writer, because in these pages, part of what I really love is the deep truthfulness, you know, the ways in which the scenes trace minute emotional movements, the ways in which we really follow this couple and their love story through all of these ups and downs. And even saying ups and downs makes it sound much more crude than it actually is. So this book, the story is set in London. I've never been to London, but I really felt like, you know, you took us to the pubs, you took us to these nighttime walks from subway stations. Can you talk about bringing London into these pages?
Yeah, of course. I think I owe a lot to Zadie Smith, like in the way that like I think we're very different writers, but something that I have noticed through her work, which I really love, is that there's always this sense of Northwest London running through it. Even when it's not directly about that place, there's always a sort of like nod to it or a mention. And I think there's something about that reflects what I was saying before about like someone trying to work through something. I think like it's the same for me. Like I've spent the vast majority of my life in Southeast London, and it's really like this kind of like small world that I inhabit that's like so rich. And I know that like I'm going to spend a long time like working through and writing about this place. With Open Water, I really wanted it to function almost as like a third character to the work. Like I wanted it to be like this portrait, in a sense that you know, you have the man, you have the women were also that Southeast London could be like the canvas on which they were moving through. And it added a texture, I guess, to the work, like being able to like really like delve into the feeling of being at like a jazz night in London, or kind of like taking one underground to another, or like going from bar to bar to bar. Or even just like, I have like a bit of like a kind of love-hate relationship with London because it's such an expensive city, but like summertime in London just reminds me of why I'm still here. Like, I'm just like, oh, like this is, there's something very special about the summer in the city. I don't know how it feels in like in New York, but I'm just like, when summertime comes around, I'm like, okay, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, same. I feel like similar sentiments for New York. It's so expensive. Mm-hmm. You hate how much everything costs here because it's just priced for, I don't know, people who work in finance probably. but it's still, you know, now that summer is coming, the streets are so green. And like we were just talking about, there's such a sense of brightness and optimism. And we have birds visiting our windowsill, which is super nice. But speaking of textures in this book, so there's London, but there's also, you feel the really rich influence of all kinds of movies, music. Can you talk about those other influences on the book?
Yeah, of course. I think there was something that I did in like one of the really early chapters where they meet in the bar, and I described, I think it's Idris Muhammad and Curtis Mayfield. Yeah, I described these two songs that could have been playing at that moment, and like I wrote it and I read it back, I was like, oh, this has taken the narrative to a dimension that like I couldn't have imagined that it would, like it had afforded this new, like another layer, like another texture to it. And it also, I was like, these are two songs which like I genuinely would hear at a night out, or that I would genuinely like just play, like because I love them. And so I began sort of like unconsciously a lot of the time, like I would be writing and then I realized, okay, like this song that I know would be right here, or when I knew that there was like a difficult emotion or a difficult like kind of, I was really wrangling with how to express something, then I knew that I could turn to other pieces of work that I was like, okay, like I know that emotion because I've seen it in that work. I know I've seen that in Moonlight, or I know I've seen that in Roy de Caraba's photography. And so in a sense, it kind of became this like symbiotic relationship where like these emotions and feelings that I was trying to map, like if the words failed me, then I knew that there were other modes of artistic expression that I could turn to and be like, oh, I can map the emotion using this photo or using this film. And in doing that, it then afforded these characters a lot of texture, because it, for me, like writing these things down, I was like, this is like genuinely, this is stuff I'm engaging with all the time. So like, I hope it feels honest and that like these characters might do so too. And it was really lovely to kind of like have almost like this archive in a sense of all of the work that I love, or that like people, that people might be able to engage with. And it's been really nice having like readers kind of either find new work or tell me like that something really resonates with them as well.
That's beautiful. And as you're talking about this book tonight, I feel like it's becoming even clearer to me how many different ways you can read this book. You know, it's a love story, it's a story of place. There's so much here about movies and music and other artistic influences. But of course, one of the most important things that the book does not shy away from at all is that these two people who are so in love, who are so wonderfully trying to protect this place of softness and gentleness, still live in a really hard world. And you know, there's a line which I want to ask you about, and I'm going to butcher it, forgive me, but it's something like, living with so many constraints as a Black man is a kind of death.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, like I was thinking a lot about the work of Sadia Hartman, and how, you know, like I quote her like a bit later on in the book, and she describes this, I'm gonna butcher her. She describes how she, like, you know, how like this transition of Black people from slavery to emancipation has still rendered a lot of Black people kind of like as seen as servile and abject and subhuman. And I think like something as small but is really like momentous as being, not being seen in the way that you want to, that is a kind of death in itself. Like that's a death of an identity that you have knowingly or unknowingly forged for yourself. And you know, like there were a couple of like interactions with the police in this novel where even something like walking past a policeman and knowing that you're so much closer to a death than anyone else, knowing that like the wrong person or the wrong sort of glance or look, the wrong circumstance could mean your demise. And that in itself, like walking around with that information is a definite in itself. That's like it's really difficult to live under those circumstances, to live and to really thrive, knowing that that is what your life is.
Absolutely. For anybody who is joining us a tiny bit late, I'm just going to remind you that we're talking about Caleb Azuma Nelson's debut novel, a brilliant book called Open Water. Please read it. You can borrow it from the library. You can buy it. There's a link in the chat to buy. And I think if you buy, like Jason said at the beginning, you get a book plate signed by Caleb. Let's zoom out a little bit. So you published this book in a pandemic. How has the publication experience been?
It's weird because there's like, it came out in the UK on the 4th of February, and then in April in the States. And this, it all feels like relatively normal for me because there's no like, so there's no measure, like it's the first time doing it. So I'm like, okay, yeah, cool. Like it kind of feels like we're just making stuff work, and it feels like it is. Like I think one of the advantages of the pandemic is just like that I've been doing a lot of virtual events, and it's meant that it's been able to reach a lot of people, a lot more than I could have anticipated. I will say I'm very much like missing doing like face-to-face, like in-person stuff. But like knowing that the book is like, is finding its readers, is finding its home. I'm really grateful for it. Cause I didn't imagine that in 2021, I would be putting a book out, which yeah, it's really cool. to put it simply, it's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, what everybody watching might not have realized is that you're in London where it's 1 a.m. Oh my God. Yeah, so this is, this is a wild thing that we can do because of Zoom and because we're all online. And also thank you for staying up so late for us. have you picked up any new hobbies or activities during the pandemic which have been sustaining?
My birthday is around Christmas, and so I try and buy myself like a big gift. So yeah, just to like be like, oh yeah, this is my thing now. And I bought this year, I bought myself a saxophone, and I've been slowly teaching myself to play, which has been, yeah, it's been wild. It's really like, it's really fulfilling. I live in a flat that has like, we're on the ground floor, and then there's a basement below us, and then there's a floor on top of us. So if it's usually I practice in late afternoon, early evening, and so there are people in. So I go to the park, like maybe 60 seconds from where we live, like big open space. And I just play for like an hour, like in the open air. And there's something so like wonderful about that. Like very, it's like really freeing to like just be out in the open and to be like, yeah, like it's gonna take me a while to get good at this thing. But like I spend like the first like 10 or 15 minutes just like playing and improvising. And there's something very like freeing about just being out in the open and just like making sound and expressing myself in a way. So yeah, that's been one of the big things that I've done. I've been eating a lot. That's like I don't know if that's a hobby, but like I definitely eat like at least one extra meal in pandemic times per day. Probably isn't the greatest idea. But I've been cooking a lot more and baking as well, which has been nice.
Wow. Well, I feel like cooking and baking and eating for sure are a lot more relatable than I'm learning a new musical instrument and one that is as, I don't know, it looks hard to me to play the saxophone. That's really cool. You're not allowed to have that many talents, Caleb. Let's see. So we have questions coming in already. And for everybody watching, I'll just remind you to please put your questions in the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen, and we will start looking at them. Richard Harper has several questions. I'll ask one. Loved your book. You seem to move effortlessly between poetry and prose. What are the challenges of both forms? Do you write poetry?
I don't know. Although like people keep asking me this, and I'm like, no, I don't.
It's because the book is so, the language is so rich and poetic. I can see it though.
I was like, I got sent a commission like a couple of weeks ago to write a poem for a magazine, and the woman was like really confused that I didn't write. She was like, that like, can't be right. I owe a lot to poets generally, but especially for Open Water. Like I was reading a lot of poetry when I was writing this. I've got a copy of Magical Negro by Morgan Parker that's like, it's falling apart at this stage. And it's one that she signed as well when she came to London. And it's like the spine is just kind of like beginning to crumble because I've just read it so many times. And Kayo Chingoni, Raymond Antrobus, who's a deaf poet, who's just like in such an incredible writer. And Langston Hughes and like Gwendolyn Brooks, there's like an interpolation of You Will Call in the book. When I was writing, I would spend my first hour or so just reading poetry and just kind of like getting myself into what felt like a nice rhythm to read and to write. And so, yeah, like poetry wise, like I owe a lot to those guys, but I don't know if I can do it myself. I really don't know if I could.
Those are beautiful recommendations though. So is that part of your writing process? Maybe that's a good segue to ask you about what your writing routine looks like, given that you do all of these other things as well.
I tend to like, I feel like, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm always writing. Like whether it's kind of like, I'll have a notebook close, or I'm like trying to scribble some notes in my notes app on my phone. But I tend to, like characters tend to come to me like really early on. Like I think they're always like the basis of the work. And then I kind of begin to hear like snippets of dialogue that like these characters might say, and I'll like write and note them down. And then I start to like frame narrative around that dialogue, or try and wonder like where these characters could go. And a lot of the time alongside that, I'm just kind of like, I'm reading. Like there's a short story that I wrote for Esquire magazine in the States over in the UK. And at the time I was reading Homie by Denise Smith. And like, there's a couple of like very clear and like direct influences that like I only noticed after the proof came back to me, and I was like, oh yeah, it's because I read that poem. And so a lot of the time it like I see like other people's influences in my work, but I think I spend a lot of time with my characters and a lot of like gestation time. Like I will hold off writing for as long as possible so I can hear my own voice as clearly as possible. And then I'll just like, I'll commit, like I will go like without turning back, kind of like full steam ahead. We'll get this draft done. And I'm someone who I tend to write quite early in the day, like by like mid-afternoon, I'm like wiped. Like I'm kind of just like, so I try to write for like a solid block in the morning, and anything else is a bonus.
We have a question from Tim Totter, who says, I'm sure you've been asked this 1,000 times, but can you talk about how you got to the second person voice in this book? Is it supposed to double for an intimate photograph the way first or third person wouldn't?
Yeah, the second person was a really conscious choice, because it was the most intimate way of telling this story. Like it allowed me a lot of freedom in writing, but it also means that when readers are engaging, they're both like audience, but also their protagonists. Like when questions are being asked and you're like reading those like aloud in your mind, it's like you're actually asking yourself that question as well. And so that pushes you like even further into the narrative, which is what I wanted. I wanted the reader to like, I knew that I had gone as close as possible, so I wanted the reader to feel the same thing. And yeah, just it really fostered this kind of this intimacy with the characters, but also between writer and reader.
Yeah. I mean, the second person is so hard to pull off, and you do it so marvelously. It's really beautiful. There's a question from the person's email has free library in it, so I think it's Jason. Did the writing of the book influence your photography work?
Yeah, I think like previous to writing this, like I often describe my work, my writing, my photography in kind of two different spaces, but in writing this it allowed them to come together, and also allowed me to like take the liberty of being okay, like these things are just hand in hand. So often when I'm writing, or when I'm like thinking about writing or planning scenes, like I see like narratives as photographs, as like snapshots of people's lives, and I'm often like the jump off point for me a lot of the time is like what like has happened to bring these people to this moment, and what could happen from this place. And those are like very like big and open questions, but it allows me to kind of like roam these various characters' lives with a sense of freedom, knowing that they could do anything. And that's the same sort of thing that I want to afford people with my photography. So it kind of, the relationship there, like kind of, it just gets closer and closer and closer.
Yeah. There's a question from Mark Willingham, who says, the descriptions you read are so specific and beautiful. Please talk more about the challenges of writing what you see. Is it harder to write what you've seen or what you imagine, or is it the same? And the second part of the question is, can we have a link to see your photos if they're up online somewhere?
So it's interesting because like a lot of the time when, especially with this book, like I'm asked if like my work is like directly autobiographical. And it's a question that I feel like a lot of writers, especially debut writers, I'm sure you don't get asked. And it's like, there's always going to be like parts of us in the work because it came through our lens. And so a lot of the time, like what I have seen informs what I can imagine. And what I've read can inform what I can imagine. It's just kind of like everything is sort of coming through me if it's being outputted. So that relationship is very, you know, if I've seen something, then it's gonna say, okay, like I can imagine this, or a lot of the time it's like, what I'm always thinking, like, how expansive can I make what I am imagining? And that often goes past what I have seen, but it's still related to it, because if I've seen something and I haven't agreed with it, or I've like wanted more, then I've done the imagining work there.
Yeah. I really like that. Yeah. And of course, like what you're writing, I think in some ways is always linked to the emotional truths that you are interested in, you are questioning, you are reaching for. Yeah, yeah. This kind of made me think for some reason about so we've been talking about all of these like serious craft questions. What did you find most fun and enjoyable in writing this book?
Some of the instances where like I just got to like write about even music, or like nights where like I've been out listening to music were really good. Like it was just kind of like, yeah, like I think there was there's a jazz night in Deptford in Southeast London that I kind of like wrote about, or like an imagined version of that night. And it's a group of like, I think it's like 10 or 12 musicians who they get together every Wednesday and they just play like continuously for 4 hours, and they don't practice. That like, they just get in and like someone starts playing and then they start improvising around each other, and like by the end of the evening everyone is just like sweaty and tired because you've just been dancing to like the most incredible music. And the like band leader reached out to me and was like, is this my night? Is this the night that you were describing? I was like, yeah, it definitely is. Which was really special. But I think, yeah, there's this like, I was so conscious of like the element of music within the novel. There's a US-based artist, Arthur Jaffer, who like I saw give a talk at the Serpentine Gallery in London a few years back. And he said something that's always stuck with me. He said that like Black music is one of the only spaces that Black people don't have to be marginal. And I was really thinking about that when I was writing this novel. I was like, okay, like if that is a thing, like how can I like kind of afford this narrative, this sense of music, which can free these characters, or can free this narrative? And also like, how can I tap into my own inherent rhythm to like afford myself a sense of freedom? So yeah, that was really cool. I think also the editorial process was really enjoyable. Like my UK and US editor like worked on it simultaneously. And then I got the edits and like, I refused to look at them for like a couple of months. Like I opened the document. I was just like, nah, it's fine. it will get done. And I booked when we could still travel like really freely, I booked a trip to Spain. And planned on spending like a few days with one of my closest friends, and then going to the coast, like by the water, to edit this book. And in that first few days, I got really bad food poisoning, and was like just completely I couldn't do anything. Like I was kind of like looking at this stack of paper, and I was like, is this getting done? But after a few, luckily, like when I went down to the coast, like after a few days, like I felt better, and just kind of. I got into this really nice routine where like I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go take a swim in the ocean, which was like yeah, also very freeing. And then I'd come back to where I was staying and just like work on this. And it was like, it was the first time that I'd done a really like rigorous editorial process. And there's something really wonderful about kind of like asking questions that have been asked of yourself and really delving a bit further into the narrative and really pushing yourself. Like I think like in general, overall, I really enjoyed writing this novel.
That's so great to hear. So your US editor, Katie Racian, was the one who introduced me to the book, first told me about it. And I just want to shout out Katie for being
the best.
Brilliant. and lifting up this book so beautifully. Mark replies that based on your answer about second person, maybe you've created a new voice, which we might call second person photobiographical. Karina asks Caleb, well, she says, Caleb, I love your work so much. I'd love to know if you're thinking of working on other novels. Are you working on new projects at the moment?
I'm working. There's a draft of a novel like hiding somewhere wrong on my hard drive and waiting to be like returned to and like completely undone. Like I wrote it in the first lockdown that we had in the UK. It was obviously like a very like stressful time and a very sort of like uncertain and anxious time. And looking back at it, I'm like, okay, I can see where like I'm gonna go in and redraft and perhaps tear it apart a little bit. So I'm excited to get to it once I kind of get in the right headspace. For now, I'm just trying to like enjoy this time as much as possible. I'm also working on like some film and TV project, which is like a very like different medium, but is like kind of like lets me like flex with like my like visual side a lot more. So yeah, there are a few things on the go.
That's exciting. There's a question from Tina Bliss. Oh, if you were trying to evade answering questions about your photos, Tina is also interested in your photos. Where will your photos be shown? How can we see them? I'm interested to see how your visual project plays out after reading the book.
A lot of my work is on my Instagram, so I can pop that in the Q&A box. But I'm like thinking about, yeah, I'm thinking about kind of like collating my work at the moment and putting together an exhibition, which I would love to kind of have both like physical and also virtual. Like I think that something that has been shown in the pandemic is that like usually I'll get like really jealous of like exhibitions that take place in New York or in like Washington and Philadelphia because I'm like, I can't see any of this, but now a lot of galleries are sort of putting work online and having online viewing, so I'd love to be able to do something like that so that people could engage from wherever.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. Katie Racian, your editor, replies in the Q&A, which I'll let you look at it.
Katie.
I have a question for you. So, you know, hearing you talk about music, mm-hmm. part of what occurs to me is that, you know, there are so many different love stories in this book. There's a love story between the two people, of course, but there's also such great love for art, including music. I wonder if working on this book has in any way changed or shaped your own thoughts on where you encounter love, and that thing, that originary thing about love as a site of freedom. Have you come to think about love differently?
I think maybe it hasn't changed, but like I feel like my ideas around love have just been a bit more expansive, and have really like thought about the various ways in which I love and also express that and how other people do that, do the same towards me or for me. And yeah, like really taking a lot of joy in these various different expressions of love, especially in this time where like things have just been so like, yeah, there has just been so much uncertainty and so much like trouble in the world. And like, that's, yeah, that's something that like I've just taken a lot of solace in, like knowing like just how much the love there is around me and how much like the people are capable of giving. Yeah, like I was talking to someone today about like this idea of writing something, like writing a novel and then like continuing to write, like you don't really like set off on like another path, like you just continue down where you started. Like it's very difficult to turn back around and then go like a completely different direction. And so yeah, I'm still kind of, I won't say looking for answers, I'm still like on the journey in a sense of trying to understand these various ways in which like love can be a place for freedom, and the various ways in which like I love and the people around me love as well.
That's really beautiful. And since we are pretty close to the end time, and I know it's nearly 1:30 in the morning for you, and your bed is probably calling you, maybe we can wrap up with one last question I have, which is, would you like to share any advice for all the artists in the room, whether they're writers, photographers, dancers, musicians? What advice would you give us?
I think having like a sense of faith, like I feel like such a big like realization for me was how much like faith is involved in writing and like showing up to the desk and like having willingness to be vulnerable or to try to express yourself. I think that's like a really important, and it can be a real struggle, and sometimes like that faith can wobble. But I think it's something to hold on to say like, you know, there are things inside you that need expressing, and to continue to try to do that, even if it's you're doing this one day and you take a break and you try again, like to continue to try, I think is like, yeah, such a big thing.
That is a beautiful and inspiring and booing note on which to close. I can't believe you had all of these eloquent, precise things to say at like 1 a.m. But thank you so much, Caleb. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. I hope you will read this beautiful book. I first read it months ago, and I think about it all the time. Thank you so much, Caleb. Thank you,
Jason. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.